Good evening, everyone. Thank you very much for the invitation to come here to talk. I very much enjoyed my visit. I've spoken to a lot of people doing a huge number of varied things in Jean-Marie's group, and it's been very stimulating, so thank you for that. I'm going to tell you a little bit about what we've been doing in my group in Oxford. The focus is on making new materials. We're focusing on, as you can see, layered materials like these oxide chalcogenides, which I'll say a little bit about, where we've got, say, an oxide layer intergrown with these chalcogenide layers. So I'll say a little bit about the how we can control the physics by doing chemistry in those compounds. And in similar vein, I'll talk a little bit about these iron-based superconductors, which emerged a few years ago. Again, the focus is on using chemistry to control the physics, and a lot of what we do is low temperature chemistry, so that's actually what I'm going to focus on in this lecture, focus on low temperature chemical routes to making new materials in these classes. I'd like to acknowledge the people in my group at the moment, several postdocs and students and undergraduate researchers. We have important collaborations with Oxford Physics, other colleagues in Oxford Chemistry, and we're very reliant on international facilities for neutron, synchrotron X-ray and microscopy facilities, and we collaborate with colleagues like Claire Gray at Cambridge. I'll talk a little bit about that work. And we're grateful to have funding from various organisations, mostly in the UK. So just to introduce this, the first part of the talk is going to be on the iron-based superconductors, and I'm particularly going to focus on the intercalation chemistry that we can do with iron selenide in order to control the composition, the electron count, and therefore the properties. So what we've done offers some insights into the chemical factors that control superconductivity in those compounds. And in the second part of the talk, I'm going to talk about the chemistry and properties of these oxide chalcogenides. I'm going to focus on compounds with this structure, of which there are many, and I'm going to talk about how you can control the magnetism and physics in general of the transition metal oxide layer by doing chemistry in this coinage metal chalcogenide layer. So the focus is going to be on doing soft chemistry. The overall concept is exploring new intergrowth compounds, because you can see all these compounds are composed of, say, a perovskite oxide block and these anti-fluorite type chalcogenide blocks, and it's a similar story in the iron based superconductors. So that's a general theme. So I'm going to start with the superconductors, and just a little bit of a reminder of where superconductivities come from. So superconductivity was discovered just over 100 years ago, and this was in elemental metals, and gradually the superconducting transition temperature edged up as people discovered superconductivity in a range of alloys, things like niobium tin, intermetallic compound, and the alloy niobium titanium are widely used in superconducting magnets. So those are the main technological materials. In 1987, it was discovered that there were a whole class of these copper oxide-based materials, layered cuprates, and they were discovered originally in derivatives of lanthanum copper oxide. This yttrium-barium copper oxide is one of the sort of best known. It was the first to superconduct above liquid nitrogen temperatures, and that one is being explored for commercial use. These are compounds that defy a full understanding of the physics and why they superconduct at high temperatures. Other compounds like magnesium boride were discovered, which have unusually high transition temperatures. And then, unexpectedly, there emerged this series of iron-containing materials, iron arsenide containing layered materials, which were discovered about 2008. And there was a sort of rapid development in these high TC materials, and again these defy a full understanding of the physics. And how do you discover a new superconductor? So it's not easy. I mean, I would say the cuprates and the iron-based superconductors emerged somewhat by accident. People were doing sensible chemistry with sensible elements, but you often don't know what you're going to discover, so I think that's a good guide. In those compounds, superconductivity is close to magnetic order, so that's probably a good place to look. Doing chemistry is very important, as I'll show, because you often have to move away from the stoichiometric compositions to find interesting properties dominated by mixed valence. Bob Carver is an expert in this area, so he wrote a nice accessible article a few years ago now, essentially saying that things are likely to emerge by accident. He said, if that superconductor is made, if the next superconductor is made by doping concrete, I'll know it's time for me to retire. And sure enough, a year later, there was discovered by Hosono's group in Tokyo a concrete-like material that's an electride, has electrons as some of the anions, and that shows superconductivity, albeit at low temperatures. So it's a very common phenomenon, and I don't think Bob's retired yet. So, these materials were discovered in Hosono's group, as I say, and what they were looking at compounds with this structure type. They were interested in transparent conducting oxides with this structure type, and they took this Rn2 plus compound and they made a chemical substitution of some of the oxygen by fluorine. So this adds some electrons if you maintain the anion to cation ratio, and so it reduces the iron slightly. And in that compound, superconductivity emerged at an unusually high temperature, about 26 Kelvin, and that sort of fired the starting gun in a whole range of researchers around the world investigating other compounds that had the iron arsenide layers. And in general, they all superconduct. And you can control the compositions by carrying out chemical substitutions on the counter ions. So substitute barium by potassium to this time hole dope the system, formally oxidize the iron, and that induces superconductivity. So we got involved with this. So one of our contributions was to work on sodium iron arsenide with this structure here. And it sort of demonstrates the sort of generic phase diagram for these compounds. So sodium iron arsenide, when it's stoichiometric, is an antiferromagnet. And it shows a very small proportion of superconducting material. And it very soon edges into the fully superconducting regime if you substitute some of the iron by cobalt. So this introduces some electrons. It also introduces some disorder, which probably disrupts the magnetic ordered state. But very quickly, you emerge into this superconducting region. But these compounds have quite a complicated phase diagram. So in this region here, the magnetism and the superconductivity really coexist. Every iron atom participates in both states because there are sort of multiple bands at the Fermi level. Some of them are involved with magnetism, some of them are involved with superconductivity. So they're quite complicated materials, but like in the cuprates, like in the copper oxides, the antiferromagnetic state is close to the superconducting state, and it's suggested that magnetism, magnetic fluctuations, are the thing that forms the Cooper pair to support the superconducting state. And some of these are promising, so it's only now, I guess, in the last 5 to 10 years that the copper oxides are being exploited as materials for high field magnets. So for example, some of the highest field NMR magnets are incorporating now yttrium barium copper oxide central portion in the magnet. So those are becoming technological materials. There are challenges with making wires and tapes out of them, but those are being surmounted. In terms of the iron-based compounds, they're not yet used technologically. The generic phase diagram is shown here. Again, we've got this magnetic state, and then if you get the electron count right, you emerge into the superconducting regime. So if you start with barium iron arsenide here, and compare it with potassium iron arsenide over here, they have the same structure, and you there's a broad range of superconductors in this intermediate range, so a broad range of electron counts. But of course, you've got in this compound you've got disorder between the potassium and the barium, and that hampers the properties a little bit, having chemical disorder. So you make a compound with the same electron count that's got ordering between the potassium and, in this case, calcium, because they're different sizes and charges they can order in this compound. So now you've got a compound with no disorder, but it has exactly the right electron count to be in this sort of sweet spot here for having a high TC. So this seems to be one of the most promising materials for making into wires and tapes for potential application. And it has quite a high critical current and a very high critical field. So it's got some desirable properties, but all these ceramic materials are quite a challenge to make into devices. So what I really want to focus on is, you've seen how the electron count is important, so I want to demonstrate that in the context of materials based on iron selenide. So this is a lowish temperature superconductor in this layered polymorph. So we've got edge-sharing FeSe4 tetrahedra. It's the anti-PBO structure. And it's been explored a lot by physics groups trying to measure the Fermi surface, understand these compounds. And if you, to sort of cut a long story short, if you look at the bands that cross the Fermi level, there are bands that dip down below the Fermi level and have a few electrons in them, and there are bands that poke up above the Fermi level and have a few holes in them. And it was discovered that if you put a monolayer of FeSe onto a substrate that is an oxygen-deficient strontium-titanium oxide, that injects some electrons into the film, and you can fill up these holes, and this compound then superconducts at rather high temperatures. So that seems to be controlling this Fermi surface, drives you away from the magnetic state into the superconducting state, and you can do a similar thing with a bulk film of FeSe decorated with potassium atoms, which of course inject their electrons into the solid. So it's a similar story. So can we imagine intercalating into iron selenide? Can we intercalate in here to add electrons? Because that seems to be what we need to do. So there are some compounds that were examined, which were sort of, you could think of as intercalates of iron selenide. They contain alkali metals in between iron selenide layers. But if you make these at high temperatures, they're always iron deficient. For every potassium or rubidium that you want to add, two of those, rather, you remove one iron. So you maintain the electron count. So you generate a very highly deficient iron selenide layer, and the vacancies order in this pattern. And these compounds are basically antiferromagnetic insulators with localized moments on the iron 2+ ions, except that if you measure some of the samples, you see evidence for superconductivity in filamentary regions where there seems to be no iron deficiency and rather less of the alkali metal. So several groups have explored those compounds. So the question is, can we maintain these stoichiometric iron selenide layers and inject some electrons by doing soft chemistry instead of working at high temperatures? And if you blast it with your classic lithiating agent, that you find that's too aggressive, so you extrude the elemental iron and make lithium selenide. So that was our sort of first attempt at that. But there are other sources of lithium, so metal ammonia solutions, these that form these beautiful solvated electron solutions. When you react that solution with iron selenide, you do get a metastable material. It was discovered by a group of Ying and co-workers, but the structure wasn't analysed. But it was clear that there was a compound where this was the sort of approximate structure. The nitrogen's a long way from anywhere else, so it can't quite be accurate. The TC, though, has gone up to 40 Kelvin, so this is clearly something's happened to the electronic properties. So we made a sample of this. This was a time when there was still sort of quite feverish excitement in these compounds. So we have good access to neutrons at the ISIS facility, so we made a sample of this with deuterium instead of hydrogen, which is sort of more cooperative towards neutrons. And so you can refine then the whole structure and see that you're intercalating lithium, but you're also intercalating the solvent as well. And we can locate all the atoms, including the light lithium and deuterium. And you deduce from this and from chemical analysis and from thermogravimetric analysis that the compound contains quite a bit of lithium, some amide formed by the reduction of ammonia and with the release of a little bit of hydrogen. But overall, there are electrons injected, about 0.2 electrons per ion injected into this compound, which is sufficient to drive it into the superconducting regime. And so it's very similar in composition to these filamentary regions, which were deduced to have this sort of composition. And we've retained this stoichiometric iron selenide layer. So we wanted to look at how that compound forms by doing an in situ X-ray diffraction experiment of this iron selenide reacting with this metal ammonia solution. So again, we have good access to facilities very close to Oxford at the Diamond Light Source. And there's a colleague of mine, Dermot O'Hare, had already done some experiments looking at chemical transformations using this versatile beamline that is used for a whole range of experiments, from looking at strain in aircraft wings to exploring chemical processes. And basically, it's an intense X-ray beam, quite hard X-rays, and a very sensitive detector, and you can measure a full diffraction pattern in less than a second. So what we did was set up a suitable glass Schlenk tube in this beam, turned the beam on, and then we had a way of tilting by remote control this system, so the iron selenide would fall into the reaction mixture and it would be sort of stirred immediately while we were observing it in the using the diffractometer. So this is 2 minutes of beam time here. Oops. We've got the background here is because of the liquid and glass. If the iron selenide falls in, you see these peaks grow in, but then very quickly they're replaced by a new phase that's growing in. So this doesn't take very long, as I say, a couple of minutes, and these iron selenide peaks have sort of gone away and been replaced completely by the product that we're forming. So it's a very simple, this is really just a glass, thick-walled glass Schlenk tube modified with this little arm to contain the iron selenide, made by our glass blower so that it's sort of safe for use with ammonia at room temperature. It's the most worrying thing about these experiments is the pressure inside that vessel. We can do it at low temperatures using this sort of rudimentary cryostat. And the product that we made, well, we were expecting to make the compound that we'd analysed using neutron diffraction, we would have expected to see a compound with the first diffraction peak, which is characteristic of the iron-iron separation, would be about 8 angstroms, but it was much larger than that. So the product that we'd actually made was one that was not the same as the compound we'd explored before. And of course, we are doing this experiment and probing it while the sample is suspended in liquid ammonia. And we discovered that we'd made an ammonia-rich phase. So that's why this separation is larger. And that's the refinement. So this is the picture that we've got. When we do this reaction in liquid ammonia, we first of all make this ammonia-rich phase where the lithium is strongly solvated. And then in the lab, when we're preparing dry material, of course, we allow the ammonia to evaporate off. Then we evacuate and you lose half the ammonia, but you can put it back in. If you know that this phase exists, you can make it by exposing the sample to ammonia at low temperatures. So we were able to do that and generate the neutron diffraction pattern, which enabled us to locate all the atoms again in this phase. Electronically, so this is now a non-redox process, so these two compounds are very similar in their superconducting properties, both TCs of about 40 Kelvin. In fact, higher, 40, 45 Kelvin maybe. Depends where you're standing. So again, we've got about 0.2 electrons per ion in these compounds. And we can do this chemistry with all the other ammonia soluble metals essentially intercalate into iron selenide. So the other alkali metals, calcium down to barium and the europium and ytterbium can all be dissolved in ammonia and intercalated. Every system is a little bit different, but the similar story is that you increase the electron count, reduce the iron, and make a high temperature superconductor. So effectively what we're doing is what has been done in these iron selenide systems and fill up these holes. So I'm now going to talk about another system where we're again controlling the electron count and controlling the properties, but it's a slightly richer system in terms of the range of phases that we make. Once you know what you're looking for, you can sort of go looking for it. So we're looking for compounds with pristine sort of iron selenide, iron chalcogenide layers, iron slightly reduced to fill up those holes. And it's also been suggested that two-dimensional materials are desirable. In other words, if you've got a large separation between the layers. And there was a report of a hydrothermal synthesis that led to compounds that had a high superconducting temperature, although the composition wasn't entirely clear. So we sort of followed that work up, and this using this sort of intermediate temperature hydrothermal method where you put simple reagents into a Teflon liner that goes inside one of these stainless steel autoclaves and does up like that, and heat that at about 200 degrees. Work under very basic conditions to avoid making things like hydrogen selenide. And you make incredibly crystalline material. This is the powder pattern from the light diamond synchrotron. And you can do single crystal X-ray diffraction on the sufficiently large crystals. And what you deduce is that you've got iron selenide layers, but then there are a whole lot of atoms that, well, they looked about the same as oxygen in terms of their scattering of X-rays, but they were a long way from the selenium. So structure didn't really make sense until you do the neutron experiment. And then you can deduce that you've made a hydroxide selenide. So there are hydroxide ions here, a sensible hydrogen bonding distance to the selenium. And we've got a layer here that is mostly lithium hydroxide, but some of these atoms in the middle are iron, which is why with this mixture, it sort of simulated an oxygen in the X-ray. The electron count was a weighted average of those. It's about 20% iron, 80% lithium. And the other thing that's variable is the iron content in the selenide layer, and that depends on the precise iron content in the synthesis. So what we discovered as a consequence of that is that there are a whole range of properties. Variable transition temperatures. So some of the compounds were not superconducting at all. They never became diamagnetic. Others were diamagnetic, superconducting therefore, but at various temperatures. And there was also a range of lattice parameters for these compounds. So there was obviously a phase width. And so we correlated those things. And it's clear that the compounds with the the longer C parameter and the shorter A parameter were the superconductors, and the refined iron content in the selenide layer was almost 100%, so almost fully occupied, 95 to 100%. But then the compounds that were not superconducting had a different set of cell parameters and quite a deficiency of iron, so down to 15% deficient in these cases. And you could make a sample, measure the lattice parameters, and predict accurately the TC. So it's very robust correlation between whether they superconduct or not and what the TC is. And that's this correlation. So the iron site occupancy, when it's a certain amount, it turns on superconductivity, and that correlates with the iron oxidation state being slightly reduced, which I flagged up earlier as being important. And if you probe the position of the iron K edge it's at lower energy, i.e. the iron is reduced. For the superconductors, slightly reduced relative to iron selenide, the iron deficient materials have iron in a higher oxidation state, so it's all consistent. So we've got this range of materials, some of which superconduct. This slide shows the importance of doing post-synthetic chemistry. We naively thought that perhaps we could inject more electrons by inserting lithium into the vacant sites here. So a student, master's student, reacted lithium ammonia with these compounds made hydrothermally, and the consequence was that a slightly mediocre looking superconductor was turned into one with a much higher TC, a sharper transition, a larger diamagnetism, so a larger volume fraction. So why is that? The crystallinity is retained, so that's good news, because it means we can do a before and after neutron diffraction experiment to look at what changes when we do this lithiation. And we did this in two cases, so one of which was this modest superconductor. The other one was one that didn't superconduct at all because it had a very low iron occupancy in the selenide layer, in the parent material. So what we discovered when we did the lithiation, we discovered that the iron occupancy increased to 100% in this layer, in both cases, in whichever, you know, whatever it was to begin with, it increased to 100% when we reacted with lithium ammonia, and the lithium occupancy in the selenide layer increased by the same amount. So we're inserting lithium into this layer, but we're not changing the total amount of iron in the compound, because what's happening is the lithium is entering the hydroxide layer and it displaces, remember, the 20% of iron that we had in this layer is being displaced, part of it is being displaced to fill the vacancies. So we can make our sort of pristine iron selenide layer and introduce electrons by inserting the lithium atoms effectively from the lithium ammonia solution. So we've got a reductive intercalation that also makes us a stoichiometric iron selenide layer. So, and this is the derivative of the iron absorption edge, so it shifts to lower angles, consistent with the reduction of iron. So again, it's the same argument that we're filling up these holes and turning on high temperature superconductivity in these compounds. So there is a consistent picture emerging about how we can control these iron selenides, and it's sort of robust from series to series. And you can probe a lot of, you know, those pictures are sort of derived from experimental measurements of the angle result photoemission spectroscopy, which you can do on single crystals of these lithium hydroxide selenides made by other groups, as well as the deposited iron selenide films. You can see that you've got a full electron, you've got a full hole pocket, you've got no holes left, been filled with the injected electrons. So the next stage, so it's then important to look at a series of reagents. Different reagents may give you different results. So we did this lithiation on these compounds using two other reagents, lithium naphthalenide. So the naphthalenide radical anion is the reductant. So this behaves in this case very similarly to lithium ammonia. And we did this, the reason there's so much data here is that we did this using the in situ setup. We wanted to look at what happened. And very quickly, the lattice parameter increased as we lithiated, and then it was flat, so the reaction was over. In this case, we started with a compound that was more iron deficient, so there was a greater change. We inserted more lithium, displaced more iron, but again, the reaction stopped pretty quickly. But what we discovered was that with butyl lithium, which is a more robust lithiating agent, much less easy to decompose than lithium naphthalenide or lithium ammonia, that the reaction carries on going, so the lattice parameter doesn't stop changing in either case, and in fact, it sort of saturates at a similar point. So what we deduced here is that when you do this initial lithiation with lithium naphthalenide or lithium ammonia, you don't get beyond the point where you've inserted lithium and displaced sufficient iron to fill these vacant sites. Anything else requires a more robust lithiating agent, because the next stage is to insert, if you want to insert more lithium, there's still some iron remaining in this layer, but it can't go into vacant sites. It's got to be ejected completely from the structure. So that's the sort of thing, elemental iron is the sort of thing that's going to decompose your lithiating agent if it's a fragile one, like lithium ammonia or lithium naphthalenide. But butyl lithium is more robust, so it just keeps on churning, and lithium keeps coming in until we eject all the iron, either into these sites or completely out of the structure. So we can see that here, that in the fully over-lithiated compound where we've used butyl lithium, the iron content has dropped. We've got a stoichiometric lithium hydroxide layer and a stoichiometric iron selenide layer. We've got a very magnetic sample because it contains some elemental lithium, elemental iron, and we've lost our superconducting transition. So we've turned off the superconductivity because we've now made a compound where the iron is not reduced below the plus two state in this stoichiometric material. So we've accessed, if you like, the parent, what you might think of as the parent compound, the stoichiometric compound of this series, but you have to access it via this multi-step process. You can't get there, as far as we know, directly. But the composition, the refined composition from a combination of X-ray and neutron measurements supports the idea that it's fully stoichiometric. And using the structural parameters that we derive, Rosa Valenti and her group calculated the Fermi surface and deduced that indeed we did, because we've got iron in the plus two state, we've got this whole pocket again, which is a signature of not superconducting, which is consistent with our measurements. Okay, so hopefully I've shown you the chemical factors that control superconductivity in these iron selenides. There's quite a rich chemistry here. We've got these solvent-rich phases that we can make using the metal ammonia intercalations there in equilibrium with solvent-poor systems. And we've also very clearly come up with the chemical parameters that influence whether these compounds superconduct or not. And the in-situ reactions, I think, are important. So we've done a few more. This reaction is very similar in bismuth selenide, for example. It doesn't do anything electronically very exciting, but you can make this range of ammonia-rich and ammonia-poor phases with other layered chalcogenides. And the in-situ reactions sort of sometimes enable you to discover these metastable compounds. Okay, so what I want to talk about now is still some soft chemistry, but in a different class of compounds and sort of with a different aim. For a while we've been looking at these layered oxide chalcogenides with perovskite type oxide layers, for example, and then antifluorite type copper chalcogenide layers normally, so copper sulfide or copper selenide layers here, and you can sometimes make those with thick copper sulfide layers. This structure is very versatile. There's a lot of flexibility. We can carry out a lot of substitutions, and these compounds as a whole are members of a sort of my more diverse extended family of these layered oxide chalcogenides and oxide pnictides. Laurent Cario's group has also done quite a lot of in Nantes has also done a lot of work on these layered materials, and so we're always trying to look at new members of these. This structure, as I said, is quite common, and it exists amusingly in the sort of antitype, where you exchange cations and anions, or even discovered by Kanatsidis's group, a sort of half antitype where you retain the copper selenide layers, but you've got the antitype of this metal oxide layer is a four-coordinate oxygen by the metals instead of a four-coordinate metal by the oxygens. So there's a lot of versatility in these compounds. You can put a lot of different metals in the oxide layer, typically mid to late transition metals. You can also often support compounds with a range of transition metals in the chalcogenide or pnictide layer. And the thing we're doing is stabilizing unusual coordination environments for transition metals. So this very distended coordination environment for a transition metal is not so commonly encountered in oxides. So we're able to make compounds with different ligand field characteristics. And you can carry out a lot of substitutions of all these sites effectively to control electron count and lattice parameters. So you can substitute strontium by barium or calcium, sulfide by selenide or telluride. You can put a range of metals in these layers. So the soft chemistry angle started when we were investigating the cobalt-containing compound with a COO2 layer and a copper sulfide layer. So this is an antiferromagnetic compound. We were interested in measuring the magnetic moment, and we discovered, if we did a series of measurements using neutron diffraction, we discovered inconsistent results. So sometimes we had a large magnetic moment, other times we had a much smaller ordered magnetic moment, and we weren't quite sure what this was, what the reason for this was. But then we discovered, we did an experiment where we took one sample and measured it, and then we exposed it to air, moist oxygen, and we were able to change its ordered moment, decrease that a lot. We changed the cell volume significantly, and we changed the refined copper content in the sulfide layer by about 5%. So those are significant changes. The crystallinity is retained, and you see evidence for a little bit of copper oxide forming. So what we're doing is deintercalating a little bit of copper by exposure to moist air, and this oxidizes the cobalt a little bit and introduces disorder and reduces the moment, the ordered moment. So that gave us a clue that we could do chemistry in these chalcogenide layers. And we've exploited that further. So if you start from the silver-containing compound, you can intentionally deintercalate silver using iodine in solution. And you can turn the antiferromagnetic compound, stoichiometric compound, into a compound that shows a ferromagnetic transition at low temperatures, and you don't see any sign of you don't see any magnetic Bragg peaks anymore. So we're exactly trying to understand exactly why this is, whether it's become an itinerant ferromagnet or not. It's slightly elusive at this stage, but we can change the physical properties dramatically, and I'll show that a little bit more in the context of the analogs with manganese oxide layers. So this is, there's a series of compounds with MnO2 layers, with chalcogenide layers of different thickness. And the interesting thing about these is, because manganese is rather more oxidizable than cobalt, you can stabilize an oxidation state between +2 and +3 by incorporating a copper deficiency in the materials made at high temperature. So in the case of manganese, if you make these at high temperatures, they're already copper deficient, even before we've done any deintercalation. So a quarter of the sites in this compound are vacant, and the manganese oxidation state is +2.5. And the vacancies, the copper ions and the vacancies order at on cooling, so they're disordered at high temperatures, but there's some diffuse scattering in the electron diffraction pattern, which crystallizes, and you see new Bragg peaks emerge in the X-ray diffraction pattern because you get ordering of the vacancies on the long range. So the copper must be pretty mobile in that case. And the magnetic structure of these is dominated by the mixed valence. So there's work to be done on these compounds for comparison with mixed valent oxide manganites, where oxidation states between plus 3 and plus 4 give very interesting physics. Here we're between plus 2 and plus 3, but like in the oxide manganites, we see prevalence for ferromagnetic ordering, in this case in zigzag chains in the structure as a result of the mixed valence. We can deintercalate some of the copper, again using iodine, so we can take out another 10% of the copper, retain the crystallinity. The manganese gets a little bit oxidized, but the copper doesn't get oxidized. And the properties, the structure and the properties change. So the structure, now we've got to accommodate a third of the copper sites being vacant. So this is work done with Joke Hardeman, who did the heart of stem imaging. And you can see here we've got a copper occupancy wave. So you've got bright spots here, a lot of copper, dimmer spots, brighter spots, dimmer spots. Very good at this time of day when you've got slightly half-closed eyes. You can see that pattern very clearly. This is a cartoon of it. High copper occupancy, low copper occupancy, on a period with a periodicity that's several unit cells. The structure, we had a lot of help from Artyom Abakumov in analysing this incommensurate ordering of the copper ions and vacancies on the long scale. The magnetism changes. So instead of these ferromagnetic zigzag chains now, we've got ferromagnetic stripes. Unshaded is spin up, shaded is spin pointing away from you. And this structure is consistent with us having oxidized the manganese. We've now got two manganese threes for every manganese two. So between manganese three and manganese two, it's a ferromagnetic interaction. Between manganese three and manganese three, it's an anti-ferromagnetic interaction. It can be used to account for that structure. So by doing that deintercalation, we change the magnetic state very significantly. Okay, so the related soft chemistry that we've done is more relevant to the sort of battery context, and it involves taking these compounds. We deduce that the copper is pretty mobile. It's pretty disordered. It looks like a fast iron conductor in the when you solve the structure. The copper is very sort of delocalized. So you can react this with butyl lithium. It's work we did a little while ago. And you can make this compound into one with a lithium sulfide layer, and all the copper is extruded onto the surface of the particles. You can reverse that, so you can either by exposure to air, you can deintercalate the lithium and the copper from the surface gets reinserted, or you can put this in a battery. So this was work we did in collaboration with Claire Gray. And so you make a cell with this as the cathode material. You discharge to make the fully lithiated material. You see that there's elemental copper here produced. This is the first peak in the diffraction pattern, which is characteristic of the C lattice parameter. And then you charge up. If you charge up to 2.7 volts, you don't seem to have got rid of much of the copper, but you've made the structure collapse. The lattice parameter is greatly decreased. So this isn't a single phase material, it turns out, so it's deceptively good looking refinement. If you overcharge this a little, or charge it to a higher voltage, then you do insert all the copper, and you go back essentially to the parent material with copper sulfide layers. So you get, and you've got no longer any elemental copper, and it's more crystalline as well. So we wanted to sort of explore what was happening in this intermediate region. And the question really is, well, have we got a compound where we've essentially removed all the metal from this sulfide layer, oxidized the metal, and then, as Jean-Marie was saying in his talk, you can only oxidize the metal so far. Presumably, you have to start oxidizing the anion, the sulfide. Can we do that? So this is recent work that Shinsuke Sasaki has carried out. So he was in Nantes as a postdoc. He came, worked in my group basically during the pandemic. So he took the last flight from Nantes in 1st of April 2020 or something. Managed to arrive in Oxford. Was in lockdown for about 2 months. So it didn't get into the lab, but then he did a huge amount of work. So the step that he took was to take these compounds where you've done the lithiation and you've got this lithiated material contaminated with surface copper. And the thing we hadn't been able to do was just dissolve that away. Not a trivial exercise. So what he came up with was a method of using this disulfiram reagent to do an oxidative deintercalation of the lithium, but also a dissolution of the copper because it chelates it, oxidizes it, and chelates it. So with a couple of cycles of dissolving away the copper, then lithiating again to flush out any remaining copper in this sulfide layer, going around that cycle a couple of times, and then a final delithiation step, he's basically been able to make this what we call a collapsed phase, where the lithium and copper have been completely deintercalated, and we're forming sulfur-sulfur bonds between the layers. So the evidence is the structure is complicated. The manganese doesn't really get oxidized. In fact, it's not as oxidized as when we just used iodine to take out a bit of the copper. Instead, we see evidence in the X-ray absorption edge. For the sulfur edge, we've got this pre-peak, which is characteristic of forming disulfides. You see exactly the same. This looks exactly the same as in barium disulfide, BAS2, for example. So we've evidence we've oxidized the sulfur, and there's evidence from the the heart of stem imaging shows blocks completely consistent with this structural model. Because it's gone monoclinic, there's a sort of stacking disorder. So sometimes you're looking at the layer this way, other times you're looking at it from the side, and with the sulfide units aligned in that direction. So there's a sort of stacking disorder, which makes the powder diffraction pattern relatively difficult to interpret, but you can do all sorts of stacking fault refinements now, which allow you to, with a fairly simple model and introduce some stacking, you can refine an overall structural model. And Simon Cassidy in the group is expert at that. And there's also evidence that you can make compounds where you've got a mixture of the completely deintercalated region and one that retains some copper or lithium. So this comes out of the heart of stem imaging. So you can see there are layers here that are not empty. So these are sulfide layers that are not empty, and these are the empty ones. So you've got a sort of intergrowth of those of those two types of layer. So it's not a simple system, and there may be ways we can control this and sort of almost like a staged deintercalation where we've got alternating layers like this and layers like this. So that's what we're exploring at the moment. So I think the summary, what I wanted to talk about is that these are pretty versatile compounds. In these oxide chalcogenides that I've discussed, we can harness the high metal ion mobility and the redox chemistry, both on the chalcogenide and on the metal, to make new compositions and tune the physical properties. And the physical properties in these compounds and in the iron superconductors are very sensitive to the electron count and the composition. And I think the most important lesson that we keep learning is that unusual behavior may emerge without warning. And with that, I'd like to thank, I've acknowledged these people already, just a reminder, we got together before we had to give up social activity just before Christmas. We did at least get our Christmas dinner in because Shinsuke was about to leave. So we brought it forward into November, but he's been sort of instrumental in generating new directions in the group. And with that, I'd like to finish and thank you very much for the invitation. Thank you all for listening, and thank you very much.